That was Block Party with This Modern Love, and I am joined in studio with Sarah and Tim Dare. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm pretty good, thank you. Where do you start?
That's good. Now, Tim is on the panel for the CRISPR Utopian or Dystopian Post-Nature Talk, which is late at the museum on October 10th.
That's right.
How are you feeling about it?
What on earth is CRISPR? Yeah. Help. Tim, you are a professor of philosophy at the University of Auckland. What's CRISPR? Why should we care?
So I'm not a scientist. The first bit. But essentially, it's a scientific techniques which allow us to interfere with genes in a way which will essentially promote desirable mutations or manifestations in either individual organisms, somatic cells. Mm. So we might interfere with an individual, and if we do that, then the things we do don't get passed on to other generations. But we can interfere, or I'm not sure what scientists call it, probably not interfere.
In the presses for this, there's been a distinct trying not to use the word mutation. It's gene editing.
Okay, yeah. But what you're doing...
correction is another one.
Gene correction.
Well, correcting that's implying genetic defects, though. Right. So that's
when there's a definite case of like, oh no, right. this is wrong.
Or like there's something that they feel they
can
improve.
So what I was trying to press is that on the one hand, you can edit the genes of individuals, which only manifests in that individual, or you can edit the genes of individuals in a way that they can pass on.
Right.
And they have very different ethical implications.
Mm, those two
interventions. So that's roughly what it is. And so there are scientists on the panel. Heather, I think, is
yes,
there.
Yes, Heather.
Who will be able to tell you? You know, she won't use the term mutation, I'm sure.
We have Peter Finneran, who's an associate professor in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the University of Otago, and Dr. Heather Hendrickson, who has completed her PhD in bacterial evolution and horizontal gene transfer.
See, that's the words,
so,
I think.
Okay, so they're the people you need to say what is CRISPR.
Right.
I better tell you. So now the question, you know, I take it what I'm on the panel for is to talk about the ethical issues around it. And so the background here, I think, is that this is one of a cluster of things that's going on where I think our ethics just hasn't quite caught up. So I do a lot of work with government, with predictive analytics, with big data, and that's another instance where we can do things, but we haven't quite got a handle on whether we should. And this is just another case of that, I think. And the reason, as a philosopher, the reason that's interesting is that I think we essentially develop our ethical capacity, our skills, and our ability to make judgments and so on by encountering things. What we normally do, of course, is we have lots of experience, both as individuals and as a culture and a community, and we encounter some new case, but it's always pretty much like ones we've seen before. So we reason analogically from the old case and make a small leap. But every now and then we're confronted by something which is just blue sky, and all of a sudden you're thinking, good grief, how is this like the things we've seen before? And so that's, I think, philosophically, in some ways, that's what's really challenging about this, that we just don't quite know what to do. And so one of the things we need to do, I think, is go through very carefully and work out what the ethical issues are. Yeah.
So you were talking before about the ability to gene edit, whether it's giving somebody back the use of their limb or potentially, I don't know, there's a lot of science fiction about giving people the opportunity to walk once they've become some kind of paraplegic with gene editing, which is like, great, awesome, yay for science. But the ethical ramifications of that is you could make them run even faster than a human, or just keep tweaking with things that you're then creating almost a different class of human, and who can afford that? Only the people who have the most money, and so on and so forth. And then you mentioned whether or not that gets passed on in your genetics, or whether it's kind of
right. So there are at least two things there. I mean, it's, one of the issues is around enhancement. So that we can make. We can improve, we can build a better person. and there are lots of issues around
totally.
That. Now, you know, it's not cut and dried. I mean, there are some improvements which, you know, perhaps we really ought to consider. But again, we need to think pretty carefully about it. The issue about who will be able to afford this sort of therapy, I think, is not just with enhancement, but also with treating disorders.
Right.
So treating disorders is not like enhancement. You know, so, you know, suppose we have cellular disorders that we think we can fix.
Mm.
It seems to me we may actually have an obligation to use the technology we have available to us.
Mm.
Whereas using it to, you know, make people run faster,
right,
or, you know, be better rugby players or something,
right,
that is surely just a different question. And that's a nice case, I think, where you know, we already struggle with discrimination. We're already not all that good as a species or a community in not discriminating on irrelevant grounds.
Mm.
Now, suppose, you know, we latch on to features that we just happen right now to think are the ones which, you know, are valuable, make people a morally better person, and we essentially breed for them,
right,
you know, through these techniques. That would be quite troubling. Now, you know, there may be some things, I think, enhancements we might go for. You know, gosh, imagine if you could make people less violent. You know, you could...
Yeah.
Wow. Or more compassion, or somehow, you know.
Wow! And when you're talking about character traits, that,
yep,
gets really in the hard basket.
Yeah,
because someone who might be quick to anger might also have really good gut instincts,
yep,
or something.
Yep.
You know, that might, yep, be two, yeah, sides, so, of a same, so, the same coin.
So there's a bigger thing. So there's an issue here, sort of across the board, that one of the worries about this technology is that it's not all that precise. So,
right,
so even when they are editing, sometimes the editing attaches to the wrong parts, and so then you're not quite sure. But in the you know, more straightforward case, so as you say, so let's suppose we find a gene for violence, and goodness, you know, I've no idea whether that's possible. So suppose we do that, as you say, the propensity to be quick tempered might be linked to all sorts of other positive traits.
Yeah.
And so one worry would be that we just make everything very bland, that we actually
homogenize everyone.
We homogenize everyone. And surely, you know, there are bound to be costs to that. And so, and one of the things to bear in mind, so that brings us back to this question about, you know, can we actually predict what's going to happen? And I think at the moment the answer to that is no. It's not just because the techniques are not precise, but we don't know as a community how we would respond, mm-hmm, to some of the things we do. We don't know the side effects. So we're sort of concentrating on humans, but of course all of this has implication in crops and
very much so.
You know, suppose we could make possums infertile.
Yeah.
You know, that's quite tempting. perhaps here in New Zealand, but not in Australia, of course.
Yeah.
But whereas getting rid of possums in the regular ways doesn't spill on into other generations, there are some things we might do here where you just have to work out, well, what does that mean, you know, for the next generation of possums and all the other possums and so on. And so there's a whole raft of things here where I think the first step, I think, is to work out the costs and benefits. And in a lot of these areas is a thing called the precautionary principle. And roughly what the precautionary principle says is that we ought to be cautious, we ought to put the burden of proof in these cases against risk. So we ought to be risk averse. And so even if the risks are, you know, haven't been proven, we don't know exactly what they are, we ought to be more careful about them than about the benefits. Probably.
How likely do you think this is when there is the potential for money to be made? For people to take enough time to really look at the pros and cons when they go, oh, if I put this through, I know I can be selling it for big bucks very quickly.
Yeah, so I think partly this is a question for the scientist rather than me. I think a lot of these things, that depends how easy it is.
Right.
You know, if it's the kind of thing that you can, you know, a small lab can do, you know, corporations can do, then it might be quite hard to control. If it's these are complex procedures which need lots of resources and backing and so on, then it may be a little bit easier. But presumably there'll be different kinds of controls. I think we do want a distinction between using these in humans and crops and maybe other non-human animals, and they may all be different. How difficult it is to regulate and. What you can control and what you can't.
When you say regulate and control, do we mean like at a legal level? Government saying you can't mess around with this kind of genome, sorry, until you've got the rubber stamp from us?
That is what we do at the moment.
Right.
So, at least a lot of this technology is on hold. So there has been work done. Scientists have done this with germ cells. But in one of the best known cases, the scientists themselves stopped once they began noticing that things were happening that they weren't expecting. I don't think terrible things, but you know they could see that parts of the gene, again, I'm going to be getting this wrong. Scientists tell me often, parts of the gene were being affected which they weren't targeting, and so they stopped.
Wow.
Now I've forgotten your question, actually. But
You hit on it. You're basically saying right. that there are checks and balances in place.
So there are checks and balances in place. That's what's happening at the moment. How secure are those?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, Monsanto, big companies might have the resources and the incentive to do this, and we've already seen there are lots of other problems with patenting. Can they control the seeds they produce in a way which comes back to your resource issue from earlier on that other people can't afford?
Because this is the thing, isn't like patent law is so powerful worldwide, but particularly in the States, that if your crops, say you are an organic corn farmer, your crops are found to have cross-pollinated with Monsanto TM corn, they can say, well, oi, you owe us, Jimmy, because you've got our stuff in your field when it was the wind that brought it there.
So actually, I'm not sure about whether that's right. But so patenting is something that you could control. You could regulate. But my sense is you can probably regulate quite a lot in medicine because this is unlikely to be things that people can do just quietly. But again, I may be wrong about that. So I think there's some hope for regulation. And of course, one of the things we need to do is just get sort of buy-in to this. So one reason to take it slowly is that if we anticipate doing this over a decade or something or a bit more, then you might have social buy-in to the practice, and that will be the kind of thing which will regulate in itself and will make regulation more effective. So I think it's very difficult to just impose regulation that no one's interested in, but if you can get people to think this actually is the appropriate way to approach this.
So when you say social buy-in, is that just as much education as possible and people being aware of the ethical problems, so it kind of
So I think there is a danger in these cases, so like vaccine, people respond without much information, there's stories about monsters being created, and
we do love our science fiction.
Yeah. That's right, and so you just end up with this not very well thought out knee-jerk reaction, probably against it.
Right.
One would guess, and of course, we do have to remember there may be very significant costs to that because this may be a direction which will allow us to treat terrible illnesses. And have all sorts of advantages. I think we need to be careful to bring people along. So vaccine always seems to me to be the sort of the worst case where you've got this intervention which just seems to be an extraordinary beneficial, one of the great developments, but there's a kind of culture that it's wicked and it makes it very difficult. It's always a battle. And so it would be good if we could avoid that. Yeah.
Well, very good that you're on this panel then with the scientific experts, and then we have an expert in the philosophy of ethics. Thank you for joining us. We're talking with Tim Dare, who works at the University of Auckland in the philosophy department and is going to be on the panel for late 2018 CRISPR, Utopian or Dystopian Post-Nature. That's on Wednesday the 10th of October, 6 p.m. You can get advance tickets from the Auckland Museum website. They are $30 on the door, $10 cheaper if you book online in advance. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.